This week on Making Contact.
One of the things that's particularly difficult for young queer men in coming forward and talking about sexual abuse is it can bring into question their own sexual orientation and identity and how that was developed.
I don't find the disabled queer youth through queer websites in general. There are many more resources online for disabled queer adults, however.
For some lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth, coming out can have some additional challenges. On this edition, we'll take a look at the unique perspective of LGBTQ youth on such topics as foster care, childhood sexual abuse, and disability. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. It's estimated that at least 10% of children in the U.S. foster care system identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or are questioning their sexuality. For many of these youth, verbal and physical harassment dominate their experiences in the foster care system. Many of them are removed or drop out of the system altogether, preferring to face the dangers of the street than to submit to mistreatment by peers and foster parents. Currently, efforts are being made to protect these youth from within the system. Correspondent Susanna Hines reports.
A lean 14-year-old with a shy demeanor, Ricardo is prone to lapsing into giggles. But when it comes to talking about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning issues in foster care, he's articulate and has a lot to say.
When I had a foster parent, he would tell me that I was confused and that I didn't really know what I was talking about. That I wasn't gay, there's no such thing as gay, bringing up the whole thing about going to hell.
Ricardo lives at Northern California's only gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender group home, the Clarence Anderson Group Home, tucked away on a quiet, dead-end road. His peers, June and Eric, also describe the experience of being gay in what is a predominantly straight system.
The first day I got there, I just said, okay, just so you guys know, I'm gay, so they said they didn't have a problem with me as long as I didn't get too close to them or try and hit on them or something.
If you're in a straight group home, I guess, and you're gay, you're a little bit awkward being there because you think everybody else is straight and you don't want to be the only person there that's out and feel uncomfortable. Like if you're a guy and and the guys that are straight are talking about girls and they're over there asking you questions about girls, you don't want to go, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I like guys, because you'd feel a little bit awkward.
Rudy Estrada is a foster care attorney for the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. He says that even as some LGBTQ foster kids face blatant harassment, others find themselves isolated.
One young person told us a story about how he was attacked in his group home. And when he reported the abuse to the director of the group home, he was told that if he weren't a quote-unquote faggot, that he would not have been attacked. We heard another story from a young woman in Denver who was being placed in a co-ed group home. And when she was being shown to her room on the boys' floor, she asked the person that was taking her to her room why she was being placed on the boys' floor. And that person responded, oh, you're not a boy? Well, we can't have you placed on the girls' floor looking the way you do. Instead, they placed her on a landing in between the two floors, so she had absolutely no privacy and had to sleep on a couch in the stairwell. And in fact, she said that the metaphor was not lost on her.
Until recently, there were almost no specific legal protections on the state level for LGBTQ foster youth. Now, a couple of states, California and Connecticut, have passed detailed anti-discrimination foster care legislation. In some cases, this surpasses protections for other segments of the population. Estrada explains why these additional protections make sense.
Essentially, foster care youth are people in state custody. And so if we analogize that population to, let's say, prisoners or people who are involuntarily committed to mental hospitals, and in fact, if you look at the law in this area, the evolution of the legal rights of foster care youth has really grown out of developments from those other populations. And it's clear that people in state custody in general have rights to protection, and that protection has been expanded in many places to include the right to being safe from psychological and emotional harm as well.
Wilbur believes these standards are coming at just the right moment, when caregivers, social workers, judges, and case managers are really wondering how to care for LGBTQ foster youth. She describes the wide range of inquiries she gets, which is a good deal more than she received even 5 years ago.
Everything from young people who would call, who would talk about their experiences in foster homes, to administrators of detention facilities wanting to know how to house transgender youth, to calls from public defenders about young people who had been charged with criminal offenses for consensual behavior, a very wide range of issues that were very unique to this group of kids.
Building legislative protections and professional standards into the foster care system may irk some conservative, especially religious, caregivers who categorize sexual orientation as a moral issue and follow religious doctrines that frown on homosexuality. But Wilbur counters that the provision of foster care may not be an appropriate profession for everyone.
What we answer to people who have a different personal viewpoint is that we're not trying to change people's personal points of view. What we're suggesting is that systems hold them accountable for treating all children equally and respecting the human dignity and worth of every single young person who comes into this system. Perhaps people would not choose to be foster parents if they felt that they'd have to, you know, accept into their homes people who were different from them. But in child welfare, this is such an important concept because the children who are served by this system, they're going to be, in many situations, different in some fundamental way from the people who are caring for them.
And Lambda Legal's Estrada says that designing more protections for LGBTQ youth isn't a matter of opening the floodgates to a waiting population.
We're not necessarily asking people to take in these young people. What we're pointing out is that they're already on their caseloads. These young people are already living in their group homes, and they're being placed in their foster homes. LGBTQ young people are disproportionately overrepresented in our foster care system because they are disproportionately subjected to abuse and neglect, including being thrown out of their family homes. So they're in our system. They're already there. They're already on the caseloads of organizations that may or may not have the capacity or the ability to see them.
It's estimated that a quarter of LGBTQ youth are forced to leave their families of origin as a result of conflicts around their sexuality. There's not adequate safe housing for this number of children. It's this gap between the need for safe places for queer youth and the existence of such places that drives people like Vernita Gray to be unofficial caregivers.
We started to put our names in the University of Chicago paper, The Maroon, and people started to call. And some of the people who would call and say, I don't know what to do. I've come out to my parents, or my parents know I'm a lesbian. They don't want me to live in the house anymore. I don't have any place to go. I don't know what to do. And so I said, well, come and stay at my house. There could be anywhere from 3 to 10 to 15 people in my house on any given day.
Though Gray did eventually become a licensed foster care provider, she still takes in whoever needs her help, LGBTQ kids living in Chicago's subway system, for example. Her unofficial approach is one way that concerned adults are offering real safety to queer foster youth. Another solution that provides sanctuary for queer youth are LGBTQ-oriented foster homes, like Oakland's Clarence Anderson Group Home. Kids like Ricardo and June say they like the environment and joke about how it's different from what they're used to.
Now I get dropped off with a van full of gay kids. With the boys like whining and stuff and looking gay. And the girls looking really more masculine than the boys.
I'll change like everything about any other group home because like this is so laid back. So laid back. You could, you know what I'm saying, talk to the staff, play with the staff, you know what I'm saying, wrestle here and here, you know what I'm saying, like any other group home, it's not like that.
Brian Napolitano, director of Clarence Anderson, says the nature of a specialized group home allows youth to concentrate on issues other than sexual orientation.
We're dealing with the issues that adolescents deal with, like drugs, and their foster kids. So the issues that foster kids deal with, like sexual abuse, neglect, abandonment, attachment disorders, you know, the whole nine yards.
Still, Jody Marksimer, an attorney with the National Center for Lesbian Rights, says that while separate LGBTQ homes are important, the system shouldn't ignore the harassment and discriminatory actions in mixed orientation homes.
These LGBT group homes are incredibly important for youth who are being harassed in other places and are having very difficult times. But on the other hand, the system or the county or the state can't say we're going to allow the harassment to happen in these more, you know, in the mainstream group homes. And then when the harassment happens, we'll just move the LGBT kid to the LGBT home and then every problem will be solved, because the problem isn't solved, because homophobia is actually bad for all kids. It raises kids up to believe that it's okay to be hateful and to be aggressive towards other youth because of difference. And so it's really important that the system doesn't just ignore the discriminatory actions and the harassment that happens in the mainstream setting because now they have a place for LGBT youth.
To create genuinely safe spaces, Legal Services for Children Shannon Wilbur says it's imperative to make inclusiveness a priority in every position of every organization working with youth.
That's a tall order, because what that means is everybody, from the director down to all the people who work on the front line, to the administrative staff, to everybody, model a certain way of treating other human beings. And that you see some behavior that gives the message to staff and to kids and to caregivers that everybody's welcome here. Everybody, no matter what.
For Making Contact, I'm Susanna Hines with Kristen Zimmerman.
Childhood sexual abuse is a pervasive issue. One in three women and one of six men are survivors. But despite its prevalence, it's rarely discussed in public. This issue is even more taboo in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, where stereotypes and stigmas create obstacles for discussing childhood sexual abuse. Correspondent Robin Takayama talks with people tackling issues of oppression, homophobia, and childhood sexual abuse.
A lavender house is nestled on a side street of San Francisco's Castro District. This three-story Victorian is the home to Lyric, a community center for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth. The downstairs living room buzzes with energy from a queer youth employment workshop. I'm on the third floor waiting to meet an 18-year-old Lyric youth who asks to be called Louie. Someone encouraged him to respond to my flyer recruiting queer male survivors of child sexual abuse for this piece. They thought it might be good for him to talk about his experience. 30 minutes later, the workshop downstairs wraps up and Louie is a no-show. James Gay is Lyric's clinical case manager. He says it's common for queer men to have difficulties talking about their experience surviving childhood sexual abuse, or CSA.
A lot of times in our culture, we're brought up as men and as young men to believe that we're supposed to be self-reliant, that we're not allowed to be victims. And I think one of the things that's, you know, particularly difficult for young queer men in coming forward and talking about sexual abuse is not only that social context, but also it can, you know, bring into question their own sexual orientation and identity and how that was developed.
I think in general have learned to think of intimate violence issues as personal instead of public.
Stacey Haynes is the founder of Generation 5.
So we'll talk about state violence, we'll talk about community violence, but supposedly the intimate violence is what we shouldn't talk about, don't spread the dirty laundry, you know, that kind of thing.
Generation 5's mission is to end the sexual abuse of children in five generations, or 125 years.
And we have it mapped out that way because it's a pervasive issue. And just like if we look at other issues of oppression, whether it's racism, sexism, those take kind of long-term strategic movements to actually change something so rooted in a social system.
One of Generation 5's strategies is to train and support organizers and community leaders to take on CSA within their communities. Mercedes Gibson is a youth activist from a low-income community in East Oakland. This multiracial, self-proclaimed lesbian says she's passionate about working on women's issues. While organizing young female sex workers on the streets of Oakland, Gibson looked for resources on sexual abuse. When she discovered Generation 5, she committed to the 9-month training.
Beforehand, you know, I was ignorant. I just was like, oh, it's you know, tragic that it happened. And I had a picture of a specific population it happens to rich people, to poor people, only to single mother families. So it just shatters all those beliefs. And you basically, the first part of the training is learning that is being like, forget everything you thought you knew about child sexual abuse. Then it talks about the different aspects. It talks about not only identifying as a survivor instead of a victim, but working with survivors and working with offenders. And then you get into work groups.
For Mercedes' work group, she held a special training for volunteers on Lyric's Youth Talk Line, the only peer-run queer youth hotline in the country. She guided call takers on how to support a caller who discloses being sexually abused. But Stacy at Generation 5 says some queer organizations are reluctant to integrate CSA issues into their agenda.
It's understandable, you know, in the queer movement, if what folks are trying to say is nothing is wrong with us. We should have fundamentally the same rights as people who identify as heterosexual, that they want to take anything that's been used to pathologize them and distance themselves. And, you know, on one hand, I get it. Of course, people are like, want to get away from anything that seems like it will bring an attack. And again, on the other hand, we kind of let this conjoining of issues continue if we don't say, no, we're going to ally, and then we're going to actually take it apart and kind of show all the holes in the argument.
One of the stereotypes that people believe about child sexual abuse and sexual orientation is that sexual abuse causes someone to be queer.
Again, James Gay.
It's really important to remember that there are straight, gay, bisexual, transgender, there's multiple individuals that have been sexually abused, that the child sexual abuse in and of itself didn't cause that.
Conversely, James says queer youth tend to believe they are the cause of their abuse. He says queer youth don't have the same opportunities as their straight peers to explore their sexuality through dating or the prom.
And so many times they go into environments or where they're more likely to be abused. So that can be going into public restrooms or, you know, going to bars underage.
Malkia Cyril, a 30-year-old survivor, was just 13 when she came out of the closet. An adult female camp counselor started a sexual relationship with her that Malkia felt was wrong, but didn't say anything.
As a queer youth, you're not supposed to say you're gay anyway. Much less say that the relationship that you're in feels abusive, because by the nature of it being queer, societal standards have already labeled it as wrong. So there's just a very unclear line between what's wrong because the society says it's wrong and what's wrong because it's abusive and violating.
Malkia is a working-class Brooklyn native and the daughter of a Black Panther. For the past 9 years, she has been organizing for racial and economic justice in the San Francisco Bay Area and co-founded a national media justice network. But until recently, she could critically identify and fight against all kinds of injustice, except for the personal one committed against her.
So the first time I really recognized that child sexual abuse was in my history was actually related to the failure of a relationship. And I think that happens for a lot of people, that it's often as an adult when things begin to fall apart and things aren't working the way, you know, you think they're supposed to work, that I began to realize that there were very simple things I didn't seem to know how to do, you know.
Malkia attributes these difficulties to a lack of queer role models. No one taught her how to be in a relationship or how to constructively confront homophobia. But she says other interpersonal problems stemmed from survival skills she learned from being violated.
I believe that when children have their right to say no taken from them, they learn to accommodate or violate, you know, violate others or violate themselves, you know. And that's the way children learn how to survive, you know, to hide or to dominate. And I learned to do both. And I think that that's really important because I learned to do both because I'm a woman and I'm a butch. So I both had the experience of internalizing patriarchy as a woman and internalizing patriarchy as a man. So it makes it a very complex experience, but also one with a lot of insight, I think, that's very useful to our understanding of how violence works and how inequality fosters violent conditions and violent people.
Melkia has channeled her aggressive masculinity based on fear to a creative, vibrant masculinity that she hopes will serve the world. And like Stacy with Generation 5, Melkia offers solutions that are coming from someone directly impacted by the problem. One of these contributions is Phoenix Day, a monthly holiday Melkia created for anyone affected by intimate violence. People join together and treat themselves to fun board games and relaxing massages, to talking circles and good food. And in this supportive space, they empower themselves to share their stories and share in their healing. For Making Contact, I'm Robin Takayama.
We'll have more about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Coming of age is tough enough. For youth who are queer and disabled, this time is even more difficult. In addition to dealing with homophobia and marginalization, these young adults face issues of limited access and inadequate social services. As Erica Bridgman reports, often it's a personal fight of mobility, visibility, and dignity.
Penelope Stowe is a 20-year-old student attending college in Pennsylvania. In middle school, Penelope was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, a chronic pain illness characterized by muscular skeletal pain and stiffness. Eventually, she was required to use a cane.
When I got a diagnosis, I actually lost a bunch of friends who kind of looked at my diagnosis and said, "Oh, well, that's not anything real." And all of a sudden, they decided that I'd been whining. So I just lost out purely because of that. I went from having a fairly solid group of friends at school to having about one person who I knew I could call. There were definitely a couple times when I wasn't getting invited to things purely because people figured I wouldn't say yes. And who knows, I mean, some of the things I probably couldn't have done, but some of them probably would have been fun, and I probably would have looked at my options and said, okay, I'll deal with that.
It was during this time when Penelope also realized she was a lesbian after attending a school assembly on sexuality, where a young woman spoke to the audience about her coming out experience. Throughout high school, Penelope maintained the appearance of being heterosexual. However, once she got to college, things changed.
I got to college and within a week was absolutely head over heels in love with a girl. And luckily she was with me as well. So I essentially came out because I had to come out. Despite the fact that I live in a fairly conservative small New England town, my parents are not very conservative. I didn't expect them to have a shock phase where they just kind of did the, oh my God, what? Which they did end up having. But I knew that in the end, it wasn't going to matter. So it was actually easier to come out to them than it was for me to come out to a lot of people.
In recent years, both queer youth and disabled people have made certain gains. Legislation such as the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1991 has helped increase an awareness of the rights of disabled people. Many high schools across the country have programs in the school for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning students. Penelope says while visibility of LGBTQ students at her high school has improved, the struggle for physical access for disabled students still continues.
The school itself isn't a very disability-friendly school in terms of just setup. If I had had to use a wheelchair while there, I would have had to leave the school. For the things where I did ask for accommodations, the school was wonderful. I was able to get extra time on exams if I needed them. I was allowed to type all my essays that were on exams. Things like that, which make a huge amount of difference. If you had huge problems walking upstairs, it wasn't a very good school. But that had a lot more to do with the lack of money and the lack of renovation since the ADA went through. And it is changing. They built one new building recently, which is fully accessible. And I believe they're renovating more and making them more accessible.
Miriam Kaufman, a pediatrician at the University of Toronto in Canada, and author of the book Easy for You to Say, Questions and Answers for Teens Living with Chronic Illness or Disability, says stress levels for LGBTQ youth can be higher or lower than the general population.
Stresses can be lower in teens who have put disability and being different than the mainstream into their basic identity. So coming to terms or accepting that you're gay or incorporating that into your identity might be a lot easier. On the other hand, it can be harder because, and the stress levels can be a lot higher, because the teen might feel that they're being seen as not really a sexual being anyway. They might worry that there would be repercussions for their care. Certainly, teenagers who are living in any kind of an institutional setting often know that there would be, they'd be punished for saying they're gay or certainly for any same-sex sexual behavior.
Penelope says that queer disabled youth organizing, while filled with great potential, is only in its embryonic stage.
I don't find the disabled queer youth through queer websites in general. I find them through disabled websites where somebody says, oh my gosh, I'm gay and I'm queer, how do I deal with this? Or somebody says, I'm looking to start a support group or join a support group or start this website or something like that. But it's not happening out of the gay community. It's happening out of the disabled community, or at least that's where I see it happen. There are many more resources online for disabled queer adults, however. In fact, both of the active list serves that I'm on are primarily, I'd say, people over the age of 30 or 40.
Penelope and other youth who identify as queer and disabled hope that these different movements can increase their connections and commonalities, building a stronger, inclusive community and activist platform. For Making Contact, I'm Erica Bridgman with Leroy Moore.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. This program was produced in collaboration with KPFA's Full Circle First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Special thanks to the Paul Robeson Fund, Shaping San Francisco, and Kristen Zimmerman. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a cassette or CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Brishan McKee, office manager, Dorian Taylor, outreach and distribution, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor. And I'm your host, Amy Pomerleau.